Welcome to the Progress Your Health podcast with your hosts, Dr. Robert Mackey and Dr. Valerie Davidson, a husband and wife team who specialize in bioidentical hormone replacement therapy and functional medicine. They're here to help you lose weight, balance hormones, and age gracefully. It's their mission to motivate, educate, and empower you to take your health to the next level. And now your hosts, hormone experts, Dr. Mackey and Dr. Davidson.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Progress Health Podcast. I'm Dr. Mackey.
And I'm Dr. Davidson.
So this one, we actually have another question for that someone submitted on the website. Again, if you'd like to do that, progresshealth.com, look for Ask the Doctor tab, put in your name, email, write your question there. We love to read these questions on there. So this one I think is from Bridget. Why don't you go ahead and read it?
Yeah, so we actually change everybody's name. So if you do put in your question, we'll always change the name and any identifying information.
You say that every time.
I know, but I think it's important to say.
I don't think it is.
But I'm going to read the question from Bridget. And as we always say.
One more time, what's her name?
Bridget.
I'm just teasing.
As we always say, if somebody has a question, that means there's probably thousands of other women out there that have these same questions when it comes to...
Well, this one is a little bit interesting, though. This one's a little bit unique in that respect. So,
Yes. So if you're, if you're listening to this, I'd say put in your earbuds because it's about sex.
Yeah. Maybe if the kids are not around or something, it's not graphic or nothing like that.
Anything, but they probably don't see on TV.
Yeah. They probably hear it on social media or on television or something, streaming something, but nonetheless, just a little bit of a,
ears bleed.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. So from Bridget, I have been listening and learning more. Your September 26, 2023 episode on symptoms of perimenopause felt extremely validating. Almost everything you mentioned, I am experiencing. I was first prescribed by my GYN the estradiol patch, and what you described was spot on, and I'm glad to confirm that it didn't seem right as I'm still getting my period regularly. I would be interested in your thoughts on biased and perimenopause. I'm also really related to the quote-unquote thought of no sex whatsoever and not initiating, rejecting, and feeling guilty. It can sometimes be over 6 months in between. I thought I might be losing interest because I can only think of maybe a couple of times in the last 10 to 15 years that I might have had a true orgasm. For a while now, it seems like it can be pleasurable leading in, but feeling like it's taking forever, and then it starts to feel intolerable, not pain, but more irritating, numb-like, as though the nerves have been overstimulated or irritated. Not pain, more like hitting your funny bone, where it doesn't feel good anymore, and it's quite disappointing. I found a different episode about the estrogen patch, and it was mentioned that the estriol cream applied vaginally could help with this. I also wonder about other things I've been experiencing. A lot of hair breakage, shedding, nail breakage, and a huge change in my skin, and the muffin top! We hear a lot about the muffin top. All right, she goes on to say, hoping and looking forward to a follow-up episode on symptoms of perimenopause and hope to get some insight on estrogen bioidentical compounded cream. Thank you so much. This has been helping me fill in the blanks and clear up a lot of confusion after my appointments.
She did mention an episode there, September 26, 2023. That was episode 125. What are the five most common symptoms of perimenopause? Just for reference.
What were the five symptoms?
I don't even remember.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought maybe you were looking at it on your phone.
Yeah. Well, I think we could probably figure them out. Okay. Like right now we could.
I think when we did that episode, we had five, but then we added in like another 50.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You could easily come up with depending on the day, you could come up with at least 10, but you could probably agree upon the top five. Yeah. And I don't remember what we said, but she mentions a few of them here. Certainly low libido, cycle changes, things like that. But anyways, that was episode 125.
The muffin top.
Yeah, the muffin top. Yeah, right. So there's a lot going on there. A little bit of an unusual, interesting description talking about hitting your funny bone. I don't know if I've ever heard it quite described like that before, but I know that we've heard anything and everything when it comes to sex.
You know, it is funny. Some of the things she says on here, like the thought of no sex, I've heard that verbatim, not initiating, rejecting, and then of course feeling guilty afterwards, because it's not about your partner. It's not about that you don't love and care about your partner. It's really like you're just, when you're in perimenopause, and menopause to some extent as well, is, you know, sex is just not on the brain. So a lot of the things, you know, Bridget says on here, we have heard verbatim. But the funny bone thing, that's actually really interesting. I could see that. I haven't heard of it referred like that, but it is, a lot of women do say, you know, it just kind of takes forever. That's another one I hear all the time.
Oh, well, you know, we actually just to, you know, we actually recorded this episode once already, and I went to,
We're redoing this one.
Yeah. We use this device called the Rodecaster Pro, which is just the way that we record the podcast. And it's got I got the original version of it, and it's kind of difficult on how to delete episodes or delete, you know, mess ups and, you know, different things. And I end up deleting them. We already recorded this once and I end up deleting it. So now this is our second time doing it. So that's really disappointing.
It's not a big deal. I was freaked out. You came downstairs into the warehouse and said, "Oh my gosh, I think I did something really bad." And I was thinking, what do you do? Give our credit card number away? I mean, what did he do? Deleted a podcast. It's easy. We can just do another one.
You always go to like worst case scenario.
What happened?
That's the way your brain works.
Something on fire? What happened?
Anyways, like I said, now we're having to redo it. So it was a good episode too. But one of the things we were talking about was, so she's of course in this situation of no libido, no desire, no nothing. I don't know about her partner, but you know, a lot of men in their, you know, late 40s, early 50s are on testosterone, and or are using Viagra to some extent. That's a really bad combination. You know, the husband is, his hormone needs are being taken care of. Her hormone needs are not. You know, that's not really a great way to connect, because they're sort of at opposite ends of the spectrum in that respect.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I would say, you know, some women that I work with, actually, I've said this before, because we do work on the libido a lot. It's extremely common. It's definitely in the top five when it comes to perimenopausal symptoms, is I do say, hey, if we're going to get your libido up, let's make sure that that's okay with your partner, because it wouldn't be fair if you had a good libido and the other partner didn't. So you're saying the same thing when these men, you know, which, you know, testosterone therapy for men can be amazing, but it's, you know, we got to work on their lady too.
Yeah, right. It's like I said, it's not really fair if you prop up his libido and then she's not really receptive. That puts her in a really difficult situation. Now it's going to be like, you know, hitting her funny bone all the time.
And it's not her fault. You know, she's right, you know, about feeling like she's rejecting and feeling guilty. It really is, you know, sex isn't on the brain. And then at the same time, you know, perimenopause is a phase. So in the beginning of perimenopause, there isn't necessarily as much mechanical issues going on, such as dryness or less stimulation vaginally or irritation, where when you're kind of going a little bit deeper into perimenopause, maybe cusping, coming close to menopause, then you might actually notice not only is sex not on the brain, but physically you're having, you know, dryness issues, irritation issues, the stimulation isn't the same, the nerve endings aren't the same. And when sex is painful, it's not, you know, it's not fun. Like a lot of times women will say, you know, the sex was painful, and afterwards it's actually a little painful too, because those tissues have to heal and regenerate and it's aching, that, you know, it does make them, you know, gosh, I don't want to go through this.
Yeah, right. Yeah. If it's not pleasurable, then it's not going to be, you're not going to look forward to it the next time. So of course there's going to be a little aversion there, not to mention you might not have that much of a, you know, desire innately anyways. You throw some pain into that. That doesn't sound like a fun time for anybody. No. You know, so yeah, that's a tough spot to be in for sure.
Well, I would say, you know, with Bridget, this isn't uncommon, that, you know, the first part would be, is definitely probably working more on that mechanical, physical aspect of kind of working on the vaginal tissues, the integrity, the lubrication, the nerve endings. Because if we put, you know, I do feel like there is a difference between having sex on the brain and then, you know, the vaginal tissues. So we can easily put sex back on our brain. I mean, it's not that easy. Women are absolutely complicated.
It's not easy at all.
We're complicated.
You make it sound like you just have a magic potion for that, because there is no such thing.
But you can, you know, working with that, everything is individualized. But I would probably start working more vaginally with her, so that sex isn't uncomfortable.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And that might actually help. So you're saying, I sort of know this, but you're saying it in both ways. It might help reduce the pain, but also increase the pleasure. So arousal might be easier if there's more localized estrogen available.
Yeah, exactly. As opposed to, you know, if there's some irritation, something uncomfortable, the overstimulation, as I've heard lots of women, my gosh, it takes like forever. So here's a marathon, is if they wouldn't have, if that wasn't happening, they may not be quite as apprehensive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Because there's, you know, there's no more pain there. You might be actually looking forward to it if there's no discomfort. Mm-hmm. And that's one of those things that, now granted, I'm just a dumb man. I don't really know anything. So sometimes, now I've been doing this a long time, so I don't really care one way or the other. I mean, I certainly care, but I'm not nervous or I'm not afraid to talk about it or bring it up. And maybe I might used to be, you know, a number of years ago, more so when things were done in the office. A lot of things are done virtually now, so it's a lot easier to having some of those conversations. For you, I know it's just easy because you're a woman, so people talk to you about anything and everything. For me, you can always tell there's just a little bit of apprehension for them to bring it up. But then I usually ask, maybe not on the first conversation or whatever, but most of our patients now we've had for a long time, and just, you know, hey, is there any discomfort or is there any pain with intercourse? Is there any issues? And then kind of the floodgates open because that, you know, that subject has been approached, you know, and then now there's a discussion about that, we can find a solution.
Oh yeah. Like she had mentioned here, because I love that Bridget's been listening to our podcast. She had mentioned wondering about the estriol being applied, and we've done another podcast and I've written some blogs about applying estriol cream vaginally. Now estriol is, so in our bodies, there's all different types of estrogen, but the main ones are estrone, E1, E2, estradiol. Estradiol is very strong. That's part of the patch that she was given that we'll talk about in a minute. And then estriol, which is kind of more of a weaker, gentler type of form of estrogen. So estriol you can put on the vaginal tissues, and it's not necessarily going to go quite as high in the bloodstream. Like estradiol, when you know, I don't apply estradiol to the vaginal tissues if a woman has a uterus, because estradiol can go right into that bloodstream, and then it can also cause the uterine lining to thicken up. So you have to be very careful when you're putting estradiol on the vaginal tissues. But estriol doesn't quite have that effect on the bloodstream and the uterus, but applying it vaginally can definitely rehydrate those cells. So, feel like I'm talking way too fast, but that's my nature. Am I talking too fast?
That's the way you always talk.
I always talk too fast. Yeah. But that estriol, when you apply it vaginally, it actually can help with the lubrication, the resilience of the tissues, help with the cells, actually help mature the vaginal cells from parabasal cells to mature vaginal cells. And it can help with that, with the nerve endings, with, you know, feeling more pleasurable. And on the flip side too, is I always talk about with patients and, you know, and with clients, is that the vaginal vault has its own microbiome, just like we've heard all about the gut microbiome, the oral microbiome. We have lots of microbiomes in our body, and one of them is the vaginal microbiome. And estradiol, you know, estriol, applying that vaginally can actually help strengthen the vaginal microbiome to help prevent urinary tract infections, to help prevent vaginal infections like bacterial vaginosis or yeast infections. We had talked about on the last podcast, which we'll get into here, that got erased and went into the ethers of the world or of the universe, is we did talk about Dr. Mackey, which I want to hear what you have to say, that sometimes applying it, you've noticed that some women will actually get yeast infections.
You haven't seen that before?
Not really.
A couple times with the, I would say more than a couple times, but, you know, several times, the more severe now hers doesn't seem to be quite that, you know, that significant. Not saying that it's not significant, but, you know, there's been some pretty severe cases over the years where they can't even wear pants. They can't barely sit down. I mean, they're
can't even have penetration.
And certainly not any penetration, intercourse, that is, of any sort, and just because it just hurts too much. Using estriol, in the beginning of that initiation of the hormone locally, it can kind of, you know, create a yeast infection within the first few days. So the ones that are really having an issue, or sometimes just as a caveat, especially if they've been prone to yeast infections in the past, you know, I might just mention, hey, it might not be a bad idea to have something on hand. If a week goes by and there's nothing, there's not going to be no issue. But I've noticed it most of the time in the more severe cases. So something like even the over-the-counter yeast infection treatment usually is fine. Otherwise, we would usually use a boric acid of some sort, boric acid suppository. We don't use Flagyl. We don't use Nystatin. We don't use any of the typical antifungals, and just because they tend to be a little bit too strong.
Yeah, with the yeast infection, like you were saying, I have seen that a little bit. With somebody with pretty severe vaginal atrophy, we tend to maybe go a little lower on that estriol and then kind of work our way up to try to prevent any changes in that vaginal vault, because that vaginal microbiome. So what you're saying to get that yeast infection is there's something, we all have yeast in our vaginal vaults, vaginal canals. We have Gardnerella species, which if it propagates too much, you can get bacterial vaginosis. We have mainly our vaginal microbiome is of Lactobacillus acidophilus. That's probably the biggest beneficial bacteria. So all that microbiome and bacteria is in, and yeast and everything is in this symbiotic kind of relationship. So adding that estriol might have changed the pH of the vaginal vault, causing a yeast infection. Or I see more often probably more bacterial vaginosis rather than yeast, but a lot of times BV gets mistaken for yeast infections because yeast infections are just so much more commonly known.
Sure. And maybe, but it still has a white, what is described as a white curdy discharge.
And that's not BV.
Yeah. Right. So we're, at least using that. Believe me, it doesn't happen every time. It happens less often than not. It's just one of those caveats that the more severe the situation, I've noticed it. Over the years, I've noticed it more times than that is not just coincidence, right? And that is irrespective of intercourse, right? So they're not really quite ready for intercourse yet because there's too much discomfort. They've added in the estriol cream, and within a couple of days, they have a yeast infection. So it's just one of those things to kind of pay attention to that it potentially could happen. Because a woman, intercourse for a woman is going to be the number one reason for getting any kind of a UTI of any sort. Right? Whether it's a yeast infection, whether it's a BV or a UTI, that's going to be the number one reason. If there's no intercourse, then, that there's not as much likelihood that something like that would actually happen, unless there's a metabolic issue or something else going on that would predispose.
Diabetes
or something, yeah.
But there is, for perimenopause and menopause, the hormonal changes can make you more susceptible to urinary tract infections and to bacterial vaginosis. The new term now, I always called it vaginal atrophy, which is kind of the old term. The new term now is genital urinary syndrome of menopause. That's the new one, which is kind of it's a tongue twister, like a full long one to say, but it does kind of encompass what it really means. It's not just that vaginal, the vaginal canal, it also encompasses the urinary tract as well.
Yeah, they're kind of combining them both into the same umbrella.
Because menopause and the hormonal changes can make you more susceptible.
Yeah, sure. So estriol, so just to recap, so you, when you're talking really fast and So E1, estrone, we don't really prescribe that. It's still a hormone in the body, but more, I think you said before that's more of a early puberty hormone, estrone.
Yeah, you can see a lot of estrone when you're first getting your period. That's why they are a little, have a little muffin top when you're, 12, 13, 14. And then, when the hormones start to change and you're making more estradiol, then things kind of change. Adipose tissue, fat cells produce its own estrone. So if you have a lot of adipose tissue, you actually have quite a good level of estrone just on its own, irrespective of the actual ovaries.
Yeah. Now E2 or estradiol is, so E1 estrone, E2 estradiol, that is the one that all the commercial prescriptions are made from, at least the quote unquote bioidentical ones.
Or the big box ones, you mean?
Yeah, the big box, commercial ones, yeah. Where what we're talking about, estriol comes predominantly from from a compounding pharmacy.
If you're in this country, United States.
Yeah, we made that statement and we got scolded by somebody in Europe somewhere that they do have estriol prescriptions there.
Or Scotland too, which I think it's really cool. We have people, from around the world listening.
Sure. But in this country, in the United States, we only have estradiol, but we, as you just stated though, we don't use estradiol or we don't prescribe estradiol vaginally for our patients just because it can increase the likelihood for bleeding, right?
If you have a uterus.
If you have a uterus, right. So that's why we use, as our little bit of a secret weapon, we just use the estriol. Now, frequency-wise, once these issues start to develop, you sort of have to use that, you know, some version of that, you know, estriol forever. Otherwise, you know, the frequency changes a little bit more frequent in the beginning, you know, every night to every other night to, you know, 1 to 3 times a week. And then, like I said, then it starts to dissipate. But if you stopped it completely, then all those symptoms would start to come back, you know, and the quote unquote atrophy would resume at some point.
Yeah, that's kind of the kind of bummer thing with menopause. Sure, the ovary, you know, with menopause is a natural course of life. You know, the ovaries cease making estrogen and progesterone. That just happens. Some women choose to do BHRT or some form of hormone replacement. Awesome, you know, that's fine. And some women don't, and that's okay too. It's just, you know, whatever your goals that you're looking for or health goals that you're looking at for the future, whether it's bone density, libido, anti-aging, hot flashes, sleep, you know, but some women choose not to. But that is the one thing, is those vaginal tissues really are primed by estrogen, that over time there can become quite a bit of dryness, less resiliency, that microbiome of the vaginal vault starts to change. So, but there are, you know, really great lubricants and moisturizers out there. So a vaginal moisturizer is different than a lubricant. You wouldn't use a vaginal moisturizer while having intercourse. You use that separately because that usually has like some hyaluronic acid, or the goal is to be more, it's supposed to pull up water or hold up water. So a vaginal moisturizer doesn't have any hormones in it, no estriol, but it can help, you know, rehydrate those tissues. So there is some benefit to that. And then a lubricant you would use with intercourse, you know, to help, you know, prevent, you know, friction or irritation from friction.
Right. Yeah. So a lubricant would be either something water-based like a KY jelly or a, you know, a silicone-based one.
You know. Yeah. Silicone, you know, is, that does have a tendency to kind of disrupt that microbiome of the vaginal vault. So women can be more prone that way, but everybody has a preference. I think the water soluble is probably a little bit better. But a lot of times when you do go to like the Target or the grocery store or something, sometimes lubricants are mislabeled as moisturizers and moisturizers are mislabeled as lubricants. So you just have to make sure that you're getting one that is truly a vaginal moisturizer to uptake that, you know, that water into the cell, or lubricant to help with friction.
Right. And then the estriol, usually you would apply an estriol, you know, pretty much right before you go to bed, you know, while you're sleeping, right?
So, yeah, so it's not messy. Yeah, but I do have some women that put it, you know, it's just a little bit of cream that you apply vaginally. You can put it on in the morning if you keep forgetting at night. And I do get this, you probably get this too, is what happens if I put it on, you know, the vaginal estriol and then we spontaneous, you know, have sex.
And we've done we've done a podcast about that before. I don't remember what number what it was, but someone was concerned about their partner. I think the partner was more concerned about it because they don't want any estrogen. Like, it's not a big deal.
It's okay. Nothing's going to happen to you.
A couple of milligrams. He's not going to grow boobs. You know, he'll be fine. Yeah. You know, he'll be fine.
But there's a lot of magic that can happen using, you know, estriol vaginally. So, you know, with listening to Bridget's question here, is she is not the only one, because we hear that quite a bit. Like we had talked about, you're right, us women, we're complicated. Putting sex on the brain is not that easy like it is for men, and I'm not trying to generalize here, but it's, you know, we are complicated. I do feel like for Bridget, because she's more in perimenopause, she had mentioned that her gynecologist tried to give her an estradiol patch, which would be more for menopause, and we could go into estradiol patches and pros and cons of those on a whole nother podcast or a whole nother hour here. But I would say to kind of help with, you know, with Bridget, with that, you know, with that libido, is probably actually using more progesterone might actually be a nice thing to help her with. Yeah, that.
So we're making an assumption, like we do on a lot of these podcasts. They give us a lot of information. Like she gave a lot of good detail there, but she says that she's in perimenopause. So when you hear that from a patient or something like this, what do you think of when they say they're in, what's your assumption that you're making when they're in perimenopause?
I'm not sure what you're asking.
I'm in perimenopause. So what would you assume that they're in perimenopause? So
if they have a uterus, they're probably still having a period.
Yeah, right.
Sleeping very well at night, insomnia in the middle of the night.
My point was just about having a period.
Yeah. If they have a uterus, they're most likely cycling.
And especially, it sounds like she's done some research, you know, listened to our podcast and different things. So she's obviously way educated, right? She knows a lot about perimenopause because she's been listening to our podcast so much.
Yes. Right,
so she's absolutely, she's so educated. because she's learned so much from our podcast, that we can sort of make that assumption, because she would on her own, because she's learned so much knowledge that she's gained from our podcast, that sorry, a little shameless little plug there. She would know the difference between perimenopause and menopause. Mm-hmm. And you're right, the patch really wouldn't be a good fit for her right now.
No, I would say, like I said, some progesterone, maybe looking at her testosterone levels, looking at her adrenal levels, at that cortisol, at the pregnenolone, kind of looking at more of a whole picture there. A lot of times too with women when it comes to sex drive is, you know, looking at their, if they're sleeping at night and what's their energy during the day, because most of the time, you know, when it comes to sexual relations, they may happen more in the evening time. And if you've had a long day and you're tired, a lot of women are like, oh my gosh, I have to do more work. Yeah, sure. I'm tired.
Yeah, sure. No, totally. Yeah. That's what I was saying earlier. Like, it's really unfair. Men just go to the local men's clinic and get a bunch of testosterone. They got erections for days, along with some Viagra, and their women, you know, their partners don't want nothing to do with that. And I talk to more women than men, just obviously, just for what we do. They sort of get put in those situations more often than not. Now I think it's a little bit easier for men to raise their libidos, as long as there's not too much metabolic disease going on or metabolic dysfunction. What do you think about in her case? So we've sort of decided that the patch really isn't the right idea. That's going to potentially create more problems than it's going to solve, at least where she is right now. What about testosterone for her?
You know, testosterone wouldn't be a bad idea. We'd want to test it. You can do a blood test. We do mainly blood tests. I mean, we've been doing this since 2000, or I've been doing this since 2004. You've been doing this since 2003. That was kind of the thing, is we've always done blood tests. I know that there are urine tests out there. There's saliva tests out there. There's different tests out there. But I would definitely do a blood test on that testosterone to see if that might, you know, like I'd mentioned earlier, maybe even do some blood testing on her cortisol levels, on some of those adrenal hormones, because and this is not superficial at all, because I hear this all the time, is when you do get a little extra weight gain, which can happen much easier in perimenopause and menopause, is when you have, a little, like she's saying, a muffin top or a little extra weight, sometimes it doesn't feel good. And then you don't feel like you want to, like, I have lots of women that have been married for years and they don't want to have sex because they've gained weight.
Oh, so it's more about they're self-conscious about how they look.
Yeah, I know it sounds superficial, but it really isn't. When you gain weight, when you haven't earned it, like, where did this 15 pounds come? Where did this 20 pounds come from? It can really mess with your psychology.
Sure. Yeah. No, I've heard that.
Excuse me. Sorry.
I keep motioning to you to not bang the table.
I know, and then I'm kind of a wiggler.
You just keep banging the table. Of course, because I pointed it out, now you keep banging the table. We have these microphones that are mounted right to the table, so we don't have any shock mounts. So if you bang the table, the noise goes right through the microphone. So no big deal. Keep banging the table.
I'll keep banging.
And I know you will too. So testosterone. I mentioned for men, testosterone is really easy. Just give men testosterone, sort of. It's not quite that simple, but relatively. And they're going to usually get more energy and their libido is going to go up. For women, it's not quite that easy, right? You can't just give them which we've seen quite a few times over the years. Women mentions low libido, and all of a sudden they're given testosterone. So what is your experience? I mean, it can be useful, right? But does it work every time?
It's not just, one bullet's going to get everything. It's, it's it's more of a multi, kind of approach where you're finding lots of different answers. It's not like, here, take testosterone and go be happy and have a good sex drive. It's not like that. We might look at the testosterone. We might want to get her sleeping a little bit better. I guarantee you, when you're in perimenopause, and I can speak for myself too, your sleep isn't great. Some days are good, some days aren't so good. So you're working on the sleep, you're working on the energy. Maybe you might check her thyroid. She might have some chronic underlying inflammation. There's so many things in terms of a view I'm looking on that. It wouldn't just be the testosterone. But I do.
I didn't mean it as checking the testosterone and using it as a tool to raise libido.
Yeah, one part of the tool, just using the testosterone. I remember I had a patient, this was years ago. I gave her some testosterone, for libido. And next time she came, I think I saw her somewhere else. I think I might have saw her at Whole Foods or something. And her face was covered in pimples. And I'm like, she had makeup on, but you could see it. Turned out, you know, if she thought a little bit of testosterone was going to work, she was going to put on three times the amount of testosterone I prescribed for her. And it didn't help her libido. It just made her skin break out. So there is, you know, it can be one part of the puzzle piece when you're looking at libido.
Yeah, right. Well, we've talked about testosterone quite a bit. The three things you got to be careful with testosterone, if you are prescribed it, is more on the cosmetic side. So as you said, breaking out is going to happen in the first, you know, first couple of weeks to the first month. Then you have to be worried about hair growth. So chin, where else? Upper lip.
Yeah, if you're doing too much.
Areola. Or even hair loss. Abdomen below the belly button. Now, usually you and I won't let it get to the hair loss point, right? Because we would see those other things happen. We'd say, okay, we got to tone it down. That's what I call a woman's androgen tolerance. You know, how much DHEA or testosterone can they actually handle before it affects their skin? Some women can handle, you know, very, very little. You know, we're talking, you know, half a milligram to 1 milligram. And if they do more than that, their skin lights up. Or, you know, some women can do quite a bit. But even still, you know, 2 to 5 milligram range for most women is usually where they end up most of the time.
Yeah, that would, and then you test it to make sure it's not too high or too low, even though the reference ranges on Quest and LabCorp and the labs are pretty ridiculously vast. But that would be
but testosterone for a woman, a testosterone level that's a little bit elevated, as long as those cosmetic things are not there, not a big deal if their number is elevated.
If it's up there, you know, 65 to 85.
Or even over 100, mm-hmm. right? You know, 125, as long as those cosmetic things are not, you're not going to see any of the other changes. Their jaw's not going to square, their Adam's apple's not going to grow, their voice is not going to deepen. Yeah,
that's not going to happen.
If they don't have those cosmetic things first, right? You know, the acne, the hair growth would happen before those other things. So you can be, you know, depending on the woman, you could be a little aggressive with the dosing. And an aggressive dose, in my opinion, is anything over 5 milligrams, you know, and up from there. Like you said, your patient that you saw, and she was obviously trying to achieve something very specific, which, you know, that sort of experimentation, I think, is reasonable. And sometimes maybe a good idea. What I've done with some women is I have them take it for short periods of time, you know, so they're kind of pulsing the testosterone dose over the course of a week. So Friday or Wednesday to Saturday, kind of preparing for date night. So they take a little bit extra for a few days and then they stop, right? Mm-hmm. So it gives their body a break from the testosterone so those cosmetic things don't tend to show up. You know, still kind of a work in progress trying to figure out, you know, where those dosing ranges would be. So if you're only doing it for 3 or 4 days at a time, you could kind of push the envelope on that dosing a little bit, just to see if it creates that, you know, putting the desire and the thought of sex back on the brain, right? That's really what you're trying to do. What about applying testosterone vaginally? Do you think there's any value to that?
No. I mean, I do have some women that have done that. I used to do that in the past, maybe about 15 years ago. I have had some women that have applied it and their clitoris has grown. And it can, depending on the base that you're using, it can mess a little bit with the microbiome and cause a little bit of irritation.
Yeah, right.
But I know that used to be kind of like a really popular thing is put it on the labia because those are mucous membranes. That testosterone is going to go right into your bloodstream, and in 45 minutes, you're going to be ready to, you know, jump all over the bed.
Yeah, that doesn't work. Yeah,
I wish it worked like that.
Yeah, it'd be really nice. It'd be really nice for men or for women if it was actually that.
Or for men, hey.
Yeah, right. Well, it'd be really nice for women if it was that sort of easy and kind of cut and dry. You were talking earlier about, you know, other factors to consider. So stress level for sure. Stress goes up, libido goes down. Even exercise, right? One thing that I've noticed observationally over the years that the more a woman exercises, the lower her libido is. And now you'd think it'd be sort of almost the opposite, but I think as a woman gets into her 40s and certainly into her 50s, that recovery time, libido in some ways for a woman is a good sign of balance. Their libido's there. Doesn't have to be overly high, you know, but as long as it's just sort of there, then that means their hormones, including their, you know, maybe not female hormones per se, but at least stress hormones, those things are in a good place. Otherwise, if they're not and the libido's gone, that's an indicator that things are not in a proper balance.
Yeah, like you mentioned, those stress hormones, when the estrogen and progesterone start to change, or in perimenopause, when that progesterone drops, then those stress hormones aren't being buffered by your reproductive hormones. So that's probably where a lot of that, you know, that muffin top comes from.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. A muffin top. I mean, how many women are having to deal with, you know, the body consequences of, you know, of their hormones changing, but usually it's most of the time, a lot of the time it's in a really high stress environment. And you, like you said, their female hormones are not there to really buffer it anymore in their bodies.
Would that just be like the cortisol levels?
Yeah. Cortisol, you're taking care of the kids, you're working full time, you're not sleeping very well, you're exercising on top of that, you know, you're pushed and pulled in all these ways. At least that's our population that we're talking to on a regular basis. You know, they're just frazzled. You can just tell when you talk to them, they're just frazzled all the time. No wonder why you don't have a libido, right? Because they're just stretched thin and there's no time for, you know, there's no personal time. There's no time for decompression. There's no time for them to sort of catch up. That's why, you know, exercise is just something to pay attention to. If there's a lot of frequency, you know, over the course of a week, and calories kind of play a role into that, you know, because if you think about it evolutionarily, that if you are over-exercising and under-eating, right, you're expending a lot of energy, but you're not maybe eating enough food, you're telling your brain that you're heading towards famine, right? You're giving your brain this very sort of negative message that reproduction might not be a really good idea. And things are going to sort of down-regulate a little bit. So just something to pay attention to, monitoring how much volume there is over the course of a week.
And Bridget also asked on her question, which she's got, you know, I love this. It's so thorough. There's so much going on here about what biased is. So we probably want to explain what biased is.
Yeah, oh, we got a few that we talk about bias almost every episode. But so you're mentioning the hormones earlier, so estriol and estradiol, so E1 and E2 and E3 sort of combined together. That's a pretty standard way to dose bioidentical hormones is in some combination. There's a ratio associated with that. What is the most common one that you prescribe?
With the biased, so it's got the estriol, the E3, and the estradiol, the E2 to it, and they just call that biased, is you can do any ratio you want. The most common ratio, and you'll see this in pretty much a lot of practitioners, majority of practitioners and compounding pharmacies, kind of the set ratio is 80-20, 80% estriol to 20% estradiol. And that's typically a good way to dose it more for menopause, maybe somebody just going into menopause. If someone's going into surgical menopause where they've had an oophorectomy and the ovaries have been taken out, a lot of times you might need to do more like a 50-50 ratio, or a woman that was on more conventional conventional hormone replacement, especially back in the early 2000s when it was Premarin and Prempro we had to get people off of, but even the estradiol patch, a lot of times when you're transitioning from that conventional type of hormone replacement to bioidentical hormone replacement to biased, is you would do more of a 50-50, a little bit more estradiol to bridge that gap. Excuse me. I know that Bridget was asking here about the biased and perimenopause. We don't, like we had mentioned earlier, we don't normally give estrogen to a perimenopausal female because she's already making some level of estrogen. It's mainly that progesterone that has certainly really bottomed out in perimenopause. But I have used estriol and there are a few cases where I've used a little bit of estradiol, more like a 90-10 ratio or a 95-5 ratio or even lower than that. So I have used that. I know she's asking about that, but it's certainly not that common to do a biased in perimenopause.
Yeah, right. Because they're menstruating. If they're menstruating on a regular basis, they're not ready for estrogen yet. Their body is still making plenty of it. And the goal,
or the estradiol in particular. Estriol you can use in perimenopause, definitely. I've used that vaginally and systemically a little bit, but definitely not estradiol. Yeah. And like I said, but there are a couple of cases I can name.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's always exceptions to the rule. As long as it doesn't upset the period and they feel better from it, then it's okay. So sometimes you have to go into that with a little bit of a, you know, caveat. Hey, this could make your cycle more frequent. It could extend your bleeding. It could do a few different things.
Then you test and make sure the lining is thin and we're keeping it safe.
Yeah. And if it doesn't do that, then you're fine. But, the consistency of the cycle sort of is what dictates whether or not a woman's a candidate or not. I mean, that's a whole nother topic in and of itself right there. But, maybe some localized estrogen therapy, but not necessarily anything systemic at this point for Bridget.
Yeah. So I think we pretty much, anything else on this question? I'm trying to look through, or I We have it printed up here to see if I'm missing anything.
No, I think we answered it all. I think we covered most of the things she was talking about. I mean, the muffin top, that's a tough one. I wish we had a magic bullet for that. Yeah, but you know, that's there's a lot that goes into that. All the things we talked about that affect the libido also affect the muffin top. And, you know, so what causes one of those causes both of those, all those multifactorial things.
That was the word I was trying to find, multifactorial.
Oh, okay.
Libido for women is a multifactorial approach.
Isn't that the truth? Yeah, that's the understatement of the year right there for sure. Very, very, very complicated. But
so worth it.
What do you mean?
Right, we're women, we're complicated, but we're worth it.
Of course. I'm not saying otherwise. That was not my, that, why would you say that? Why would you say you're worth it? No, of course women are worth it. We wouldn't be doing this podcast if it wasn't for that. That's what we're doing this podcast.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is conventionally there's not really that many solutions. That's why, estriol, and that's like our little secret weapon that we've been using for years and years and years that a lot of women are just not aware of.
We didn't even get into oxytocin.
Yeah, oxytocin. I mean, that's another kind of another prescription idea for libido. You and I have had mixed results with it. Some works well, some, maybe more for mood, maybe kind of as a mood elevator. I've had some that have had success with it from a libido standpoint, but not necessarily enough across the board to say, hey, take this and it's going to give you a response in 20 minutes.
I think if it's going to work, people notice it right away, because I have some women that love it and some women that just don't notice it.
Right.
The premise behind it is oxytocin, of course, is like that love hormone. When mommies have babies, they produce a whole bunch of oxytocin, and that's what helps them bond with this little helpless infant that can't take care of themselves, and they don't leave them in the woods to fend for themselves. So it's, it's like this automatic bonding. When women have an orgasm, actually their oxytocin goes way through the roof, and that's what helps them bond with their partner. When you cuddle with your dog, your pet, your oxytocin goes up. So the premise behind it was, if you can supply that oxytocin, it can help with that libido. Like I said, if there are some cases where it works really well, where you take the oxytocin, initially, in theory, when it first kind of came out several years ago, was to take the oxytocin about an hour before intercourse. But I actually find that taking it in the morning, if you're going to have more intercourse in the evening, that seems, I don't know, it seems like it works a little bit better when you take it quite a bit earlier than that. And I'm not sure why. I think maybe just kind of gets through your system and kind of, help.
I wonder if, cause you're saying all the things,
just what I've noticed in my practice.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. We're observational scientists. That's what we do. We observe people all the time. They give us feedback. We observe, we make note of it and, see if there's a pattern that emerges. You get really good at noticing patterns when you do the same thing all the time. You're mentioning a few things. Okay. So mom and baby and with our pets and all these things that stimulate oxytocin. Do you think oxytocin, and I haven't looked into the literature on this, do you think oxytocin reduces cortisol?
I bet it does.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right. We should look into that. I'm going to write that down.
Yeah. That as you are getting an oxytocin hit, you could almost consider it like a dopamine hit, but something that stimulates the release of oxytocin, you would think there'd be a reduction to cortisol at the same time as that was happening. Because the things that make you release oxytocin would actually lower your stress.
Yeah.
Right. So you'd think that maybe that's partially how oxytocin works on the, on improving libido.
Oh, maybe that's why with some of the patients that taking it earlier in the day helps reduce that cortisol level to, help.
That's what you said that. Yeah, that's what made me think that it's more of a delayed response. So just some things to think about. There's always, we're always learning more. That's the thing, right? When it comes to medicine, when it comes to human physiology, when it comes to treatment options, we kind of like the Dunning-Kruger effect. We think we know a lot, but we realize how little we actually know. And there's always, more things to learn, but that's why it's interesting. By answering these questions, it helps us steer things in a different direction and answer these questions. Just kind of maintaining that conversation or continuing the conversation over time. So appreciate Bridget for submitting the question. Another shameless plug for more questions. So you know, go to the website, Ask the Doctor, and we'll read your question on the podcast. Anything else to add?
Nope. I think this was great. Thank you, Bridget.
Yeah. So until next time, I'm Dr. Mackey.
I'm Dr. Davidson.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Progress Your Health podcast. If you like what you've heard on this podcast, please give us a positive review on iTunes. This allows us to spread our message, grow our audience, and help more people around the world. For more information, visit our website at progressyourhealth.com.